Hi everyone, Justin Chisholm here with another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this time is British professional sailor Hannah Diamond. As well as spending many years with the British sailing team on the Olympic campaign trail in a range of classes, Hannah also raced in the 2017-18 edition of the Ocean Race as part of the Vestas 11th Hour Racing crew. Having set her Olympic aspirations aside, at least for now, Hannah now splits her time between gigs as a pro sailor, campaign coach, and sailing media contributor. As we reveal in the podcast from May 2021, as we build up to the Tokyo Olympics, you'll be able to read Hannah's Olympic sailing column exclusively on the Yacht Racing website. So let's get to the interview. Well, Hannah Diamond, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. I think you're talking to me from Hamble in the UK, centre of all things sailing in the UK. You've been there for quite a while, though, with lockdown. Usually you'd be on the road, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's been obviously a really strange time for everyone. And for me, I've been here for over 12 months now, whereas normally by this time in the year, we'd be coming back into the beginning of the European season. So definitely strange to be in one place, but you know, we're all focusing on new things and reassessing where we are, so it's been a good opportunity in different ways.
So Hannah, I know you from Olympic campaigning. I know you a little bit from the Volvo Ocean Race, which you were involved with last time around, and I worked on that, but we don't know each other particularly well. So tell me a bit about yourself. I know you as a professional sailor, but how did that all come about? How did you begin your career in sailing?
Well, I definitely didn't kind of plan to be here now when I first started out. I was really inspired by Olympic sailing from quite a young age. So from kind of 10 years old, I was the kid in Oppies who was just obsessed by racing, getting myself to the Olympics. So I went up through the youth and junior classes, tried a lot of different boats along the way. I've sailed laser radials, a brief stint in the 49er FX, and then ended up in the NACRA 17 campaigning for Rio. And unfortunately missed out on selection for Rio 2016. And again, in kind of the fashion that my career seems to have taken, I ended up taking a little bit of a detour, doing some big boat sailing, which the goal of that was just to have a bit of a break, come back for this Tokyo cycle. And then the opportunity of joining a team for the Volvo came up for the 2017 race. And I thought it was just something I couldn't turn down being involved in. So threw myself into that and ended up becoming kind of more involved in the big boat scene. And that's where I've been ever since. So not taken the exact direct path I was planning to, but been very fortunate with the experiences I've had so far. Really enjoying it.
So is that the end of Olympic campaigning for you, do you think?
It's one of those things, kind of never say never. I think starting an Olympic campaign when you're 20 is one thing because you're full of ambition and drive and you don't know where it's going to take you. I think kind of 10 years on for me, it has a slightly different meaning. So if a really amazing opportunity came up, I wouldn't definitely say no, but it would have to be something really special, especially given the experience that I had putting so much into a campaign and just missing out on selection for the British team. It's a pretty emotional roller coaster to go through. And I definitely would be wanting to make sure I got to the games, not just kind of winning international medals along the way.
Yeah, because it is a huge commitment, isn't it? We all associate the Olympics in any sport with massive commitment and this long, you know, 4-year cycle. It's a long time. And I think what I've heard is you do one cycle to get used to the idea of campaigning, and then you do another one with a realistic hope of getting there. But tell us something about that life as an Olympic campaigner. It is tough, but you're also doing the sport that you love. So it must be a bit of both.
Oh yeah, and anyone who gets the opportunity to test themselves to that level is so lucky. I mean, when you first jump in, there's so many things that you don't know about Olympic campaigning. You're just on this constant evolution of kind of, you learn one lesson and you think that you've made progress, but the next event you go to, there's so much more that you need to learn. It's just, you're almost on a treadmill that is just getting faster and faster. And I think that's why you kind of see the medalists being a little bit older compared to some other sports, because it's just building up that bank of experience. And I remember coming away from kind of realizing we weren't going to win the trials for 2016 with an overwhelming feeling of kind of gratitude for the experiences that I'd had, rather than, I mean, obviously we were gutted, we were really disappointed, but it is all consuming. And I just felt really lucky to have pushed myself as hard as I could for that amount of time. I think not many people get to experience that.
Life within the British sailing team, and the British sailing team is one of the top teams in the world, recognised as that. What's life like inside a team like that? Because we use the word team, but you're all competing against each other in that class, whatever class you're campaigning for the berth. So you're a team, but you're also competitors. How does that all work?
It's really interesting. And I've had this conversation a few times kind of during the time when I was Olympic sailing and also since then with the people that were involved at the same time. And some of those relationships are really tricky to manage because you're living with the people that you're training with, but also ultimately competing against. And so it's quite a tiring lifestyle in a way, because, you know, almost every aspect of your life becomes competitive. You're kind of eyeing up your competitors, the first thing they do in the morning, like how, what breakfast they're eating. That kind of environment does become quite tiring after a while. But then on the other side of that, you have to realize that you've got the best training partners in the world. So it's kind of balancing that is part of the experience as well. And I think I found that very difficult to manage to begin with, but you do have to kind of realize that it's an opportunity, not just the situation that you're in, and you just have to make the best of it.
And from a time point of view, I mean, the good thing is you're doing an awful lot of sailing, but you're giving your whole life up to this, aren't you? I mean, you're from what I gather, you're on the road an enormous amount as an Olympic campaigner. Tell us a bit about that lifestyle.
Yeah, you're absolutely focused on one thing and one thing only, and which is part of the appeal of it, to be honest. Like I said before, not many people are in a position where they're able to really 100% commit to one goal that they're trying to achieve. And so to be in that position is amazing. But yeah, you're away for 250 days a year. You're away from friends and family. You're living in an environment which isn't very friendly all the time. You know, sometimes it's great, but other times, you know, if you've had a bad day, you don't necessarily have somewhere to retire to. You don't have your people in your corner necessarily just there. And you're trying to constantly improve yourself and your team next to the people who, you know, they can kind of see what you're doing as well. So it's a difficult environment, but it can be really rewarding when you do make those gains, which I guess is why people keep going back.
Now, you were campaigning in the NACRA 17. That's a mixed class. So tell us, who were you campaigning with? How did it work? And who was it ultimately who got that berth? Who eclipsed you on that one?
So I started off the cycle with Ben Saxton. We did 2 years together. And I think if we were both really honest, we were really surprised with the results that we got early on in the cycle. We'd both come straight out of university. Ben was previously sailing the 470 and I was sailing a laser radial. We jumped in and kind of went straight to the top of the fleet, which, I don't know, for me was definitely a surprise. And then obviously the hard thing to do once you get there is to keep getting those good results. And ultimately at the end of 2014, we parted ways and I teamed up with John Gimpson. And we really had our backs against the wall. We were both crewing previously, and then John became my helm. And we had a fight kind of from the beginning because we weren't eligible to enter any of the World Cups because we didn't hold any of the ranking points. Our helms were able to kind of keep them. So actually looking back, that pressure was great because it meant that we just had to keep pushing. We didn't have any time for distractions. And we had a really focused campaign. We were selected for the test event in 2015. And from that point, looking back now, that's kind of when things shifted for us. We realized we didn't have time to have the real fundamental building blocks of our campaign. And while we were pushing really, really hard for that first kind of 6-7 months, that was fine. But then when we wanted to break into the kind of top five in the world, we could see these kind of big gaps forming. They became really visible where we hadn't put the hours into the boat handling together. We'd done it in our previous partnerships, but we just hadn't had the time to do that together. And we struggled to kind of make that next jump. We ultimately lost the trials to Ben Saxton and Nicola Groves. So yeah, really interesting journey of real ups and downs. But I wouldn't necessarily change any of it now, to be honest.
And it's a complex web with who's been involved and who you've sailed with. And I mean, that must be, God, that adds just another whole layer to it, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, it does. And, you know, you have to be respectful of the people that you're sailing against. And at that level, you don't have a huge pool of people to select from. I remember speaking to maybe two other people when I was trying to find that partnership for the second half of the cycle. And Pippa Wilson, who John was previously sailing with, wanted to retire. So we kind of saw each other as our best options to get there, but we knew that it was going to be a big ask, just given the amount of time that we had. And to be honest, I'm really proud of the effort that we put in, the results that we did manage to achieve in that time, because, you know, there was no guarantee that we were going to be able to make it work together at all. So yeah, really proud of that.
So that bit of the Olympic dream has passed you by for the moment. So what was the reset? What did you do next?
So I went, living in Hamburg, I'm surrounded by big boat sailors. My family all sail keel boats more than they sail dinghies. So I was kind of the odd one out in that respect, following the dinghy route anyway. And I knew I wanted to stay involved in sailing. I knew I had so much more to learn about the sport. I felt like I'd just scratched the surface. And I wanted to take a couple of months as far away from anything Olympic Games as possible. And it does seem that there's kind of completely separate worlds within our sport. So I just went to do as much big boat sailing, trying to be the worst sailor on every boat I could get on, try and be the least experienced sailor and surround myself with people that could teach me things. So that was probably from February 2016. And the next 12 months just went by so quickly. I was really fortunate to kind of jump from boat to boat and sail with amazing people who ultimately kind of put me in a position to get in touch with one of the teams to try and be selected for a spot on the Volvo.
And that must have kind of a little bit come out of the blue as well, because that's a pretty high bar to try and get into. Was it a bit of a shock?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd done a little bit of offshore sailing in the UK the year before in a class 40, which was being run from Hamburg. And I was just trying to kind of meet as many people as I could, not, you know, socially necessarily, but just because I knew that there was so much about the sport that I didn't know at this point. And it's one of those things, like the Olympics have been my focus by this point for, you know, 15 years since I was a kid. And then it felt a bit strange to suddenly be in a world where I was really enjoying my sailing, and this opportunity almost fell on my lap. Whereas this opportunity, well, the Olympics was something I'd really strived for, and it hadn't worked out at that point. So I felt a bit strange about that. But I thought, you know, this might not come around ever again. This is definitely a once in a lifetime opportunity. So I'd be crazy to not give it a go. And that was that, really.
So tell us about that team. I think you said that was Vestas. You gave that little secret away. So how did the call come? Did you get a call from the skipper? How did it all work?
So I'd sent a few emails out, but I didn't really have any connections with any of the teams that had announced that they were starting the race. And I was in a scenario where I just thought I'd say yes to every opportunity that came about. So I ended up in St. Bart's, sailing with a team. I was kind of coaching them, which was, you know, not my usual kind of position on a boat at all. But obviously, if you go to a regatta like Le Voile de St. Barts, then all of the big boats are there. All of the people who are involved in the Volvo campaigns are also there. And I saw Charlie, and we'd exchanged a few emails previously. And I thought, if I could just put a face to a name, then I've got a much better chance. And he invited me to join them for Transatlantic for my trial. So I flew home, did a couple of events in the UK, and then flew back out to Newport to join the team for their crossing from Newport, Rhode Island to Gosport, kind of just down the road from where I am here. And I remember arriving in Newport, and I didn't know any of the sailors on board in person. I knew them all by name, of course, but the boat, I'd never sailed a 65 footer before. And we did a couple of days of sort of corporate sailing, and Charlie said, well, what's your role on board? And I said, I wanted to trim. So he just said, off you go, and we'll kind of make a judgment on based on what we see. So felt totally out of my comfort zone. But yeah, it was kind of the first time that I'd taken that approach to just jumping in and seeing what happened.
Wow. That's that. Yeah, I can see that having been the center of everything with an Olympic campaign, all the coaching, all the attention, and now you're the one having to prove yourself. That must have been pretty daunting.
Yeah, and I think if I look back at it now, if I was in the same position, you know, at this point in my career, I think I would have been a lot more stressed about it. I just felt really free to just throw myself in and think, I've got nothing to lose at this point. I still had time at this point to jump in and do a campaign for Tokyo, and I was very aware of that. So I really didn't have anything to lose at that point. And that was quite a nice feeling. But yeah, I think it was just pure kind of grit and determination that put me in that position. And I kind of almost felt like I wasn't going to take no for an answer. I just was going to show them that I was up to the job.
Was that transatlantic your longest offshore leg up to that point?
Oh, by a long way. Yeah. It was about 5 or 6 days in that I thought, like, this is crazy. It's a 24-hour-a-day job interview with a bunch of international people that you don't know on a boat that you don't know. I'm literally in the middle of an ocean trying to form relationships and also prove my sailing worth. So it was completely crazy. But, yeah, an amazing, amazing experience.
So aside from all of that pressure, did you enjoy the sailing? Did you enjoy the experience? Because those boats are fantastic.
Oh yeah, it was incredible, and we were really lucky. Actually, it was really windy. I think we saw over 40 knots for a couple of nights in a row, and we were really fortunate that most of it was downwind. So I wouldn't say I had a true Volvo 65 experience all the way across, because we did do so much downwind sailing. But just driving a boat like that in Atlantic swell, you know, nothing really compares to it. And obviously, because I was on trial, they wanted to see if I could drive the boat or not. And so, yeah, it was just straight in the deep end, show us what you've got. And it must have been all right, because I got the call up to join the team.
So you weren't put off by the experience. That's the other thing, because sometimes, you know, we tilt for these things, and actually, then when we actually try them, you think, oh, actually, I don't want to go around the world on one of these things.
No, it was strange, because I just think I was so determined to be part of something which I really felt like a lot of people who knew me would say that I wouldn't be able to do it. And I think that was such a big driving factor for me. I remember people saying, like, you're not tough enough, you're not resilient enough. Like, I'm quite an emotional person, and I don't necessarily see that as a negative thing. But I think from the outside, it's easy to see that as weakness. And I think I was so determined to tell all the people throughout my whole career who told me that I wasn't good enough and I wasn't tough enough, to prove them wrong. And that was kind of enough to get me through it, I think.
That's a great answer. I like that. So you were, of course, part of a tranche of female sailors who had come into the race as part of, let's call it, positive discrimination from the race organisers. I've been involved in a few ocean races, and I have to say, I think having the women involved in the race makes it a better race. I think it makes it more interesting, and it makes the crews more interesting to write about and talk to, and the whole experience, I think, is generally better. So I think that's probably something that's going to stay in that. And we've seen SailGP adopt the same approach to that kind of positive discrimination now. What I was always interested in knowing was, with that group of women that were across the boats, was there a, you probably knew some of them from your Olympic campaigning, because there was quite a lot of Olympic sailors in there. Was there a kind of sisterhood going on between you, just to kind of, you know, some kind of secret meetings during the stopovers to discuss how to deal with these men?
How to deal with them? I'm not sure if we'll be allowed to speak about the guys like that. But we had, I mean, there was a WhatsApp group, but that was pretty much it. You know, all of us came from such different backgrounds. I knew a lot of the girls either from Olympic sailing or some of the big boat sailing that I'd done in that short time. So yeah, I definitely knew more of the girls than the guys. And yeah, it was, I don't remember there being any kind of sisterhood type thing. For me, I'd been involved in mixed sailing for quite a long time by that point. In my youth sailing, I chose to sail a 29er with a male crew as well. So it was something that felt really natural to me. And it's only something that's been a conversation since I've been in the big boat world. And I've obviously been very fortunate with the time that I've entered this kind of world of yacht racing, ocean racing, things like that, because I've been able to access a lot more teams and higher level racing than I would have if I was 10 years older, for example. So I don't want to kind of belittle that at all. But I do think that if these kind of initiatives can be implemented for another few years, then we start getting to a situation where the female sailors on board are no longer the ones asking for experience and asking for pointers. They're there in their own right, and that doesn't happen overnight. But yeah, I think it's great. And I feel very lucky to have been, you know, I am the age that I am. I can't help that. But hopefully I've made the best of those opportunities.
I know the race is the ocean race, the Volvo as it once was. It's a roller coaster ride for everybody involved, whether you're on the shore team, whether you're on the boats, whether you're part of the organizing authority. And it's a long race. It's 7 or 8 months of a race, and it goes around the world. So you're away from home for a long time. You need your kind of support network around you. But I wonder, can you remember what the highs and the lows were for you in that? Can you kind of give us a little guide through what was the high point? What was the low point, maybe?
So definitely the high point was winning leg one. You know, to be a winner of a Volvo Ocean Race leg, you know, there's not too many people in the world that can say that. And especially because, you know, all the teams had a relatively short build up. We definitely weren't one of the favorites for that first leg. You know, in other people's eyes, we knew that we had the sailors on board to be able to do that. So that was amazing. There were definitely kind of other things that were incredible about the race, but almost too many to name. You know, just, I don't know, crossing the equator is something is amazing to do. Also getting around Cape Horn. But losing the rig 24 hours after rounding Cape Horn was pretty tough. Especially by that point, everyone had invested so much into the performance in the race. So for two reasons, I guess, finishing the leg, we're in a great position. So our race focus, that was really disappointing, but also then made it very difficult to, get the boat to Brazil to start the next leg. So all these things going through your mind, the elation of going around Cape Horn and then the deflation the following day of having to head to the Falkland Islands and figure out how to get the boat and the crew up to Brazil.
Yeah, I mean, that was an epic story in itself. You could probably write a book on that side of the whole thing. What did you learn from the veteran ocean racers that were on the boat? Because these guys are quite different, aren't they, from the rest of us? Let's be honest, male or female, they're different from the rest of us.
Yeah, I'd completely agree with that. I actually think anyone who crosses the Southern Ocean, rounds Cape Horn more than once is made of a different stuff. Like I've done it once and I think I'd find it very hard to do it again, knowing how hard it is. And I remember someone saying to me just before we left Auckland, like, you're so lucky you don't know what it's like yet. And I kind of was a bit unsure what that meant. And now I completely understand. I had no idea, to be honest. Nothing in my sailing career had prepared me for that leg at all. I just felt like nothing I'd done to that point had given me anything that was relevant to actually help me as an individual, but also contributing to the team, get the boat safely to Cape Horn. And I was really lucky to be surrounded by people who had done it kind of 4 or 5 times. And I remember Simon Fisher, our navigator, saying once we'd got round Cape Horn, I said, I don't know how you do that more than once. And he said, don't worry, it's not always like that. But I don't know if he was just being kind or if it was a particularly windy addition, but it was hands down the hardest thing I've ever done by a long, long way.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I can well believe that. So now with that race behind you, let's ask the same question as I did at the Olympics. Is that the end of around the world racing for you, or would you actually maybe? Because this is what I hear from all the sailors: like, oh, I'm never going down to the Southern Ocean again. No, not happening. And then the cycle rolls around, and suddenly there's their name on the crew list.
Yeah, and I kind of, when I said it, when we did make it to Brazil, but not obviously by boat this time, I said never again. And I do think I mean it. It was an incredible experience, but it took a lot from me personally. You know, it's a lot to put on your family as well. They're completely, they have no control of what you're up to. They get the race tracker updates, but that's pretty much it. Or maybe you can get them an email every 8 days or so when you kind of sacrifice 5 minutes of sleep to write something. But it's a lot to put the people who are close to you through. And I kind of feel like I've ticked that box. Very fortunate to have done it, but I don't necessarily feel the need to do it again.
I think that's a fair answer. I don't think anybody would think any the worse for you for that at all. That's a fair answer. You've been there and you've got the t-shirt and you've got the photos to prove it. So
yeah.
So fantastically well done for that. So the great news from my point of view is that we've been talking about the Olympics that's coming up in Tokyo, and you've agreed to do some writing for me for the Yacht Racing Life website. You're going to do a regular column on the Olympics and the classes. And as you know, what we're trying to do here is to just give people a reason to get excited about the Olympic sailing. Because I feel like sometimes it gets lost in the whole thing, because it's a little bit, the training is all kind of out of sight of everybody. It doesn't get masses and masses of press. But it is the culmination of one of the major pillars of our sport. And it's the Olympics, after all. So just turning your attention now to Tokyo, it could be a pretty exciting regatta if we actually have one. I mean, first of all, what do you think the chances are of it actually happening?
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the moment we're really positive that it will happen, just because we haven't heard that it won't. And definitely for all the sailors, until they hear anything otherwise, they'll definitely be, you know, really counting on it happening. It must have been so hard for all the sailors, those who had been selected before the Games was postponed last year, but also those who hadn't yet earned their selection. All of this time in limbo is really difficult to deal with as a sailor. So yeah, I think we keep our fingers crossed. The difficulty, I think, for a lot of the sailors as well, is that the normal build-up they have in Olympic sailing, you have quite a strong form book that's been built over years and years and years. And you see the people who are experienced at the Olympics, they kind of have that build-up where, you know, the beginning of the cycle, maybe they're not posting the best results, or they take a year out, and then year on year, it's the same kind of names who begin to medal. And obviously this time round, we don't have any of that. So I think it throws the form book wide open, and it should be great to watch, even if it's a bit stressful for the sailors to take part in.
And the British team has the usual strong lineup, I'm guessing?
Yeah, definitely. We've got kind of a mixture of experienced Olympians and some fresh faces. But I mean, the fresh faces, they are kind of, they've been leading the world field if they haven't necessarily been to the Olympics yet already. Obviously, we've got Giles, who's been taking some time out for the America's Cup, but he'll be back strong, I'm sure. We've got the NACRA 17 reigning world champions in John Gimpson and Anna Burnett. And, you know, the rest of the team have all posted results in the medals, but not for kind of 15 months now. So it'll be interesting to see who can perform on the day.
And what are the other top countries? Because there is a bit of a pecking order in all of this, isn't there?
There is. And I think it'd be really difficult to kind of be sure of that until a bit closer to the time, because we shouldn't forget that each nation has had different lockdown restrictions throughout this whole period. So some of the sailors have been able to train domestically at home with no restrictions. Others have formed a kind of international training group where they've been able to kind of meet up with their closest competition and essentially kind of emulate that racing environment in a location and just not move from there. Whereas others have been locked down in various places. They haven't been able to access their equipment necessarily for the whole time. And I think especially for the technical classes, it's going to be very interesting to see whether they can get their good kit out to Tokyo with all of these moving timescales with shipping and things like that. So difficult to say at the moment. I think there's some really strong Spanish sailors across the NACRA, the 49er and the 470s. So that will be really interesting to see. But past that, I think at the moment it's really difficult to tell.
Traditionally, the Australians are a strong country. And then we have countries like New Zealand who in very specific classes, obviously they have the Wonder Kids, Pete Burling and Blair Tuke. They're more of a kind of specific class kind of country, aren't they? You wouldn't expect them to win the overall medal tally in sailing.
No, and I think, you know, you've got those very strong individuals and, you know, maybe the efforts of that nation are focused more on that individual class. But yeah, you've got the other, you know, the Brits typically are very strong across the classes. Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see the people who have stepped out of the boat for the America's Cup or for SailGP and other sailing, perhaps distractions, but also those are the people who've actually been able to get racing time on the water and how that'll influence the results come time for the games.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that in a bit, maybe just push you a little bit more on that. There's been a little bit of criticism on social media of Blair and Pete for kind of not focusing on their Olympic medal and messing around with SailGP when they don't have to. Is it realistic to balance the America's Cup, SailGP and an Olympic campaign all in one? It seems like a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a huge amount. And also there's so many different pressures. It's not just the sailing. You've got kind of the extra days of the sponsorship responsibilities. And at the moment you've got all the quarantine restrictions. So you're not able to freely travel like we were before. Which further limits your days enormously. I think it really depends on who you are, where you are at in your Olympic sailing. I think if you're just starting, it's your first cycle, your Olympic class needs to be your only focus. But if this is your second, third, fourth Olympic campaign, then you're perhaps able to draw some experience or draw some lessons from sailing other classes. But I don't think it works for everyone. And ultimately, we won't know the answer to that until, you know, the medals are decided at the games and people start to reflect on whether it was worth having those extra sailing responsibilities or not.
It was impressive, wasn't it, to see Giles Scott back in the Finn at the Europeans, I think, a couple of weekends ago. Bit of a shaky start, which is not unfamiliar with some of the British sailors, in my opinion. And then back up, finished second, a fairly solid second. But he's got his work cut out, hasn't he, with the Hungarian, I think it is. Is it the Hungarian
who's
the European champion?
Yes, well, I think, you know, in those kind of classes, some of them have been sailing the boat for so many years, the muscle memory that they've collected over that time. You know, if you take a couple of months out of the boat, whether it's through other sailing commitments or say you're injured or something like that, you're able to kind of jump back in at a reasonable level. And I think probably for Giles, the racing skills that he's been used to in terms of focusing on one other boat and racing around a course at much, much higher speeds, perhaps it took a couple of days just to think about big fleet racing again. But you can see that he's completely at home in the boat, but he's definitely got a target on his back being reigning Olympic champion. And I'm sure the others have been really hungry to make their mark and use any opportunity they can get on that top step of the podium.
Talk about muscle memory. Sailing a fin, it's just aching muscle memory, I think is what you're talking about. I'm sure he didn't enjoy when he slipped his feet under the toe straps for the first time and started to hike. It probably was he was missing his AC-75
and
his helmet and his microphone to talk to Ben, I'm sure, at that point. Now, listen, we're going to kick this off in May of this year, so next month. What's your idea for you know, what you're going to be talking to people about with this Olympic column? What are you going to try and cover off?
So I'd like to kind of introduce people to a couple of the personalities and the names that we're likely to see on the podium in Tokyo. I think it's a really good opportunity to to introduce a few of the personalities rather than just the names that you see on the scoreboard, kind of put a bit of a focus on the people who have stepped, we're expecting to step up, who perhaps if the games had gone ahead when they were scheduled originally last year, maybe wouldn't have featured, but have been using this time really cleverly to keep their foot to the floor with their training so that they can make their mark on this event. I think it'd be great to generate people's interest in the sailors, you know, past the Olympic Games as well. So hopefully raise a bit more interest.
Well, that sounds fantastic. Sounds like exactly what we need. So thanks for that in advance. For now, Hannah, I'm going to sign off. We'll leave it at that. But let's try and do something a little nearer to the Olympic Games itself. Let's try and do another podcast, and perhaps we can do a preview episode, perhaps the week before the racing starts. Great. For now, Hannah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. Thanks go to my guest, Hannah Diamond, for taking the time to talk to me. Thanks also to all of you for listening wherever you are in the world. I'll be back soon with another episode, but until then, sail fast, everyone.